This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome Stephen Brill to the show. He is the founder of Court TV, which is now True TV, and the monthly magazine The American Lawyer. He's founder of the new company called NewsGuard, which fights fake news by providing reliability ratings. And he's also author of Tailspin. Stephen, welcome. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Good. Good to have you. So NewsGuard, we hear a lot about fake news out there. What is NewsGuard and how does it work?
NewsGuard is a service using journalists to solve a journalistic problem. We think every once in a while real intelligence is better than the artificial kind. So what we've done is we've hired about three dozen journalists here in the United States, and they have since last April been reading and writing nutrition labels and red and green ratings for the 2,200 websites in the United States responsible for 96% of all the news and information consumed online in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
If you download at newsguardtech.com our free browser plugin, once you do that, whenever you go online and do a Google search or a Bing search,
you'll see the ratings, right?
Use a Chrome browser and get a Facebook feed or a Twitter feed, you'll see the red and green NewsGuard icon next to all the news and information being shown to you. And if you hover over the red and green, you will start to read our nutrition label.
Okay, that's interesting. Good idea.
Our nutrition label is not just based on, well, we like these guys or we don't like these guys, or they're liberal and we're liberal, or they're conservative and we're conservative. It's nothing like that. It's based on 9 strict journalistic standards. And those 9 criteria would be universally agreed by any journalism professional.
Tell us about some of those. Can you just rattle those off or rattle a few of them?
For example, do you have a clear policy for correcting mistakes? Do you disclose your ownership and financing? Have you been found to repeatedly publish false news that you don't correct? Do you gather and present news responsibly, meaning do you rely on reliable sources or only anonymous sources? Are your headlines deceptive? Do they overstate? Are they clickbait? Or do the headlines accurately reflect the
content?
Articles?
Yeah, okay.
Do you separate news from opinion, very
mm-hmm.
importantly?
Yeah.
If I'm writing something that's my opinion, it should be labeled as such. If
sure.
I'm reporting the facts of an event, it should be labeled as such. So
mm-hmm.
those 9 criteria are weighted. And if you get a score of 60 or above, you get a green, and a score of 59 or below, you get a red. But the most important thing is the nutrition label explains exactly how we applied the 9 criteria.
Got it. Okay.
It explains if anyone has complained about it. You can read the complaint. You can see the bios of the 2 analysts and editors who wrote the label to see if they have any problems with their backgrounds, any biases they might have.
Okay, good.
It's the opposite of an algorithm. It's totally transparent.
Mm-hmm.
We call everybody for comment before we write the label. Algorithms don't call people for comment. And we want people to game our system. We want
mm-hmm.
them to say, gee, if I had a corrections policy or if I stopped running these crazy headlines, I'd get a higher score from NewsGuard.
Okay.
We launched in September, and we've done a Gallup study since of 1,000 people at random who've used the plugin, and by large majorities, they agree, A, that it's useful, B, that it's distinctly non-political, non-biased in any way, shape, or form, C, that they have confidence in the ratings, and most important, D, they are much more inclined to share articles in their social media that are labeled green and much less inclined to share articles that are labeled red. And that started the company.
So it sounds like NewsGuard vets the journalist or the news organization rather than the specific article, right?
The news organization, yes.
Okay.
So we don't solve all the problems of the world. If your local newspaper publishes something that is incorrect but is otherwise a reliable, generally professional organization, it's going to get a green.
Okay.
We may make note of the fact that they made a mistake here, but
it's always the organization, though, not the journalist, right? Not the reporter.
That's how we achieve scale.
Okay, got it.
Otherwise,
we'd be impossible.
We'd have to have a million
people. Tell me about how small do you go, though? There are so many media outlets nowadays, it's truly mind-boggling. What's the smallest outlet?
When you get to 2,200, you're getting pretty far down there. It could be a blog about, you know, the Denver school system.
Okay.
It could be, very typically, it's the news website of a local television or a radio station.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's important, by the way. That may sound unimportant, but one of the big outlets for fake news that we found in the run-up to the 2018 elections were these sites that would suddenly pop up saying News9PhoenixNBC.com.
Mm-hmm.
And it had nothing to do with news, nothing to do with
NBC. It wasn't an affiliate. Yeah, okay.
It was totally phony. It just was made to look like a real news site, and it was propagating propaganda or some crazy anti-vaxxer website, something like that.
Only two reporters, peers, two journalists do the nutrition label for each organization?
No. It's two people do a draft, two people edit it. My business partner, Gordon Krovitz, who used to be the publisher of the Wall Street Journal, and I do the final edit. So we have about three or four dozen people involved in this process here in the United States, and we're launching next month in the United Kingdom, Italy, France, and Germany.
Okay, so basically six people then, it sounds, if I got that right, vet each news organization.
Correct.
Okay, got it. And so it's not crowdsourced. Initially, I thought you were having a bunch of journalists vet news, and I was thinking they'd just vote their political spectrum. But you six people have beliefs and prejudices and biases, right? Like anybody. So there's that. But you're vetting the organization.
It's hard to have a belief or prejudice about whether a news site has a corrections policy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Fair enough. Okay. Yeah, sure.
You know, we have debates about things. And when we have a debate, every morning we have a full staff meeting with everybody. And the stuff that's ambiguous so that we don't agree on, we go around the room.
It's a
human process. It's not an algorithm.
Sure.
But the real strength of it is that everything we do, every decision we make is totally transparent. So you can see how we applied the criteria. And if you disagree, that's fine. But unlike, right now as we speak, Facebook, Google, and Twitter and everybody else, they have algorithms that have programmed in their own reliability ratings for every news site in the world. The only problem is if you're the editor of that news site, you have no idea what your rating is. You can't contest it. You can't see it even. Right. You can't talk to anyone about it because it's all one big black box.
It's secret.
I think that's intolerable.
I think it's totally intolerable in so many ways. I have been saying for years that I think these big tech companies, the platform companies, the social media companies, one of a few or maybe all things need to happen. They need to make the algorithms public, although even then we may not be able to interpret them. They're so complicated. There are so many steps to them, or they need to be regulated like utilities, or they need to be busted up under antitrust or something. I mean, these companies just have so much power. It's truly mind-boggling. They're bigger than many governments, you know. They have the power to censor and to censor without people knowing they're being censored, which is even more scary.
Right.
Yeah, ghost censor. So tell us about Tailspin, the people and forces behind America's 50-year fall and those fighting to reverse it.
This is a book I set out to do several years ago where I was trying to figure out, in essence, what happened to America. How could it be that our infrastructure is crumbling? How could it be that it is literally true that the chance that the next generation will be more prosperous and have more opportunity than their parents is no longer better than a 50-50 proposition. The whole idea of the American dream was that every generation did increasingly better. How could it be that the idea of income mobility in this country has basically collapsed.
Right.
There's a graph you can draw in terms of income inequality, to take another example, where from the late 1920s to 1970, income inequality was reduced every year. In other words, the gap between the richest people and the middle class and the poor was narrowing.
Yeah.
Beginning in 1970, it started to widen to where today it is back where it was in 1928. So it's a giant gap.
Right.
And what I attempt to do is take five or six different developments, all of which seem like positive developments at the time, mm-hmm. in the late 1960s and early 1970s, and explain how they ultimately had a boomerang effect.
All right, tell us about those.
Well, for example, global trade.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously a very good thing for the world.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously a very good thing at the beginning for the United States in the 1960s, because we had the most efficient factories in the post-war era. We had the most efficient workers. But because we failed at the kind of job training programs that every country needs to keep the middle class constantly engaged in and enjoying the benefits of the economy, and because we didn't enforce a lot of the trade rules, that became a negative, a big negative instead of a positive. Even the First Amendment boomeranged against us. Now,
yeah.
What do I mean?
I know, I'm looking at your contents and I'm really curious about that one. Tell us.
So in 1976, Ralph Nader, the consumer rights crusader,
I remember him well,
and lawyer, brought a lawsuit on behalf of discount druggists in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And these drugstores were offering discounts on prescription drugs, but they were blocked because the Virginia legislature passed a law that said you're not allowed to advertise the price of your prescription drugs. And that law had been sponsored by the incumbent big drug stores, which didn't want to worry about that price competition.
Mm-hmm.
So Nader argued in court that the First Amendment was as much about listeners as speakers. In other words, the benefit of the First Amendment was, if I can hear a variety of speech, I'm better equipped to be a good citizen in a democracy and be a good consumer in a free market. So the listeners, in this case, he said, older people and poor people who could benefit from prescription drugs at a discount, were deprived of that aspect of the First Amendment. And importantly, he said, it didn't matter if the speaker was a corporation, a drugstore, or a person. What mattered was the speech and the benefit of the speech to the listener. And the Supreme Court said, you're right, it doesn't really matter if it's a corporation that's speaking. The whole idea is that you have free speech. That morphed from 1976 into 2009 into the Citizens United decision, which basically gave large corporations a free hand under the First Amendment to give as much money to political campaigns and political causes as they wanted to. And that sort of capped two decades of accelerating dominance of money in politics.
I'm not sure if the listeners, though, get the connection between Citizens United and the First Amendment, though. I mean, I know corporations have free speech rights just like people, but what...
Part of the First Amendment is the right to contribute money to political campaigns.
Oh, because that's a form of speech expression.
Because another Supreme Court decision basically said that money is speech, that you can't speak in politics if you don't have money.
Right.
You can't buy advertising, print up flyers, do all the things that a campaign does to be a campaign.
Got it.
So there's just a blanket statement by the court saying money is speech. When you spend money on politics, that is speech.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of lobbying is that we get access to our government, right? Sounds good on the surface. The problem is, I don't have a lobbyist, but Google does. They have an army of them.
No, that's right. And in fact, lobbying, even more so than the ability to spend money on campaigns, lobbying is directly stated in the First Amendment. You have a right to assemble and bring your grievances to the government. That's what lobbying is. It's just when you combine continuing income inequality and other legal innovations and financial innovations, it turns out that, no surprise, the tens of thousands of lobbyists in Washington work for the people who can afford to pay them the most.
Yeah, most poor people don't have an office on K Street, do they?
Yeah, no. And it's pretty hard to write a law that's, in fact, it's impossible to write a law that says a rich coal company can't have a lobbyist, but someone who wants to petition Congress for more money for black lung disease can have a lobbyist.
Yeah. What do we do about that?
It starts with the political money. I identify some groups that are working against all odds, to fight for campaign finance reform. They've had some success at local and state levels. But ultimately, the solution for our country may oddly be that things get so bad that they get good. And what I mean by that is that at some point, as I say at the end of the book, there's a breaking point where people become so disgusted that they demand change. And that demand becomes something that lobbyists and all the political money in the world can't withstand.
Yeah.
Now, you could argue that in 2016, people were so disgusted that they demanded change in the form of, you know, an unconventional politician who promised them that he was going to, drain the swamp. The trick is for people who don't
think the swamp is pretty hard to drain.
Well, the trick is for those who don't think that turned out to be the right solution is for a political leader who doesn't set people against each other as a way of providing an outlet for their frustrations, but unites people. And the principal challenge there that should be doable is uniting the middle class with the poor. Because the middle class today have been so driven down with income inequality, with the collapse of private sector labor unions, and all the other things I write about in the book, the middle class today have been so driven down that they have much more in common with the poor than they have with anybody else. For example, food stamps, which conservatives are constantly trying to cut, are basically a middle class program. It's a working class program. The minimum wage being as low as it is basically means that a large percent of America's workers work at wages that are poverty level wages or near poverty level wages. So the idea that you could run a campaign and set that working class off against the poor or off against immigrants, it seems illogical if you have the right kind of a political leader who can explain that those two groups have more in common and that they're the victims of what I call the protected class in this country, and they're the unprotected class, and there are many more unprotecteds than protecteds, democracy might just work.
Very interesting. I think we just can't treat entities, corporations, LLCs like people. They're just not natural persons, and
good argument.
They shouldn't have those rights. They shouldn't have the same rights. It's just abused like crazy.
One more point, as I explained in the book, the origin of the corporation, the entity called the corporation, was in common law that it is a charter granted by the state.
But not the federal government. Has the same First Amendment. Well, yeah, but states have the same kind of reflection of that Constitution too, right? Hey, give out your website.
NewsGuardTechnologies.com.
All right, Stephen, good talking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, HartmanMedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.